And we're in our very special floating format right now. Up next, Joshua P. Warn with some incredible updates. Yes, we'll talk about ghosts, but you won't believe the story he's got when we come back on Coast to Coast AL. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, every once in a while, we'll throw a curveball at you because there are stories ongoing and breaking all the time. And we've got some updates now with our investigator, our great paranormal investigator, Joshua P. Warn, back with us on Coast to Coast. Joshua, how are you?
Hey, doing great, George, especially considering that, as you said, the paranormal data just continues to flow in. I can hardly keep up with it.
You and Tom have the instincts of cats in terms of timing. Breaking stories all the time. You were with me well over a year ago when you were telling me that you had found, you had obtained a piece of wire tape. In those days, and we're talking a long time ago, before we had magnetically striped tape for recording, they used what? Explain that.
Yes, long ago, before we had even, you know, cassette tapes and all that, we had these tiny, tiny wires that are probably thinner than a hair, which are made of steel, and these wires would function just like a tape in that they would receive a magnetic imprint and they could record sound. So very few people, I imagine, today, especially some of the young people, are even aware that we used to record on wires. But what is even more...
Josh, young people aren't even aware that we used to have 8-track tapes in our cars.
Well, that's true. You know, the other day I was talking to an 18-year-old, and she told me she'd never seen an Indiana Jones movie or a Star Wars film, and the originals, and that'll make you feel really old. But
exactly.
Yeah, so, but anyway, so these wires are rare enough, but what's even more obscure is the fact that during the 1940s and 50s, there were some spies and detectives that would actually use an even miniature version of the wire recorders so that they would have a portable system they could carry around under their coat. And a lot of times they would just have a wire, or actually a cord, that would come from the wire recorder and run down the sleeve of the jacket, and then they would have to have a wristwatch or something like that, and the wristwatch would serve as the microphone they would use to secretly record people. And even people who were working in broadcasting back in the 40s and 50s, they weren't aware that this miniaturized technology existed because it was secret and so specialized. Well, as it turns out, a few years ago, I met a woman who told me an amazing story. She said that her father used to work in military intelligence in the United States, and that during the 40s and 50s that he was gone doing secret stuff. Nobody really knows exactly what he was up to, but it was kind of difficult for his family because he didn't get to see them much and he couldn't tell them where he was going. Well, he died rather mysteriously when he was, say, younger than the average person, and not too long before he died, he went to his son and said, "I want to give you something that is really important, and I want you to keep it stored in a safe place, and don't pull it back out until I'm dead." Well, sure enough, after the guy died, the son removed the box, which he'd kept stored in a barn, so the conditions were not very good environmentally, and inside was one of these miniature wire recorders, as well as a wristwatch microphone, instructions showing this thing was made in Germany, and there were 4 spools of recordings. So no one knew what could possibly be on these recordings, but it was well known to the family that this guy had been in Dealey Plaza the day that John F. Kennedy was shot. So there was always this, you know, speculation that, well, maybe he actually recorded something. And, you know, a lot of information has been extracted by simply having a recording of the gunshots. So anything that this guy might have gathered from Dealey Plaza could have something to do with this civilian ideal that someday we'll know the truth, or something a little closer to the truth about what went on that day. Well, nobody knew how to deal with these recordings, and they are very brittle. They're in very delicate condition. And so I'd come on to your show and told you about these recordings and the fact that we had transferred one of them before using the equipment of a gentleman who was a good friend of mine, who was an elderly man who worked in broadcasting a long time. We actually had to re-spool a mini wire onto a regular machine. And what we got when we played it back was a conversation. There were men in a room, and they were talking about a bomb exploding, and they're talking about something in France. And but there were only bits and pieces, and the rest of it was just static. So it was really frustrating, but a good teaser for us. Well, then the gentleman I was working with died, and his equipment also was in disrepair. So I told you before we wanted to get these other wires transferred, and your wonderful audience sent me a ton of suggestions for places out there that would transfer this stuff. But, however, I was sort of paranoid about the fact that if I sent this off somewhere, I might never know for certain if what I got back was really what I'd sent to them. And so I'm very fortunate because there is a man in your audience. I won't give his name without his permission, but he has a lot of experience working with this type of technology. He's an elderly man, and he volunteered to repair the old original machine.
Wow.
And so all this time, this man has had this machine, and he had to go in and reconstruct parts and rebuild this in various fashions. I mean, he might be one of 10 people in the world who could have really done this for all I know. I just got this back about a week ago. Over this past week, I have been doing transfers in our new Lemur lab, which we'll talk about a little later if you want, because we're doing some crazy stuff in the lab. And we started transferring these. Talk about a headache. This wire is so fine. It would just break about every 5 or 10 minutes, and some of the wires were really mangled badly. Thus far, the work is not complete, but from what we have extracted so far, I have recordings, and I'm going to send them to you when they're all finished. I have recordings that pretty much give us a scenario in which there are a group of men, anywhere from 5 to 10 men, and they're sitting in a room, and they're having a very detailed, sort of laborious conversation about a contract in Texas.
This is incredible stuff, Joshua.
Yeah, it is. And they are talking mainly about creating some type of a new aircraft and a contract that has something significant to do with France. And they're going over all these little issues, like personnel issues, insurance. They're talking about the way the contracts are going to be drawn. There was a mention of $18 million that was being paid for some part. So as we get these recordings, some of them still are not coming back at the right speed. And so I've gotten hours and hours and hours of all this stuff transferred, and I still have not gotten to actually restore it to the speed to get the exact interpretation. Now, what I've done is sent copies of this to many, many trusted associates. So,
well, you do know. Now, what you can do, though, is somehow if we can get this into a computer,
yes,
with our auditing system, we can slow the speed down.
Well, you know, I can send you and Tom copies of this.
Do that, and send it to Tom. We'll get it to Engineer Dan.
Okay.
And we'll put it through our audio system and see if he can slow it down to where it makes human sense. And
who knows
what's on there? Do you know if there's anything specific about the JFK assassination at this point?
At this point, I have not heard the mention of the word Kennedy. And I have not heard the mention of the word Roswell or any of these other keywords that a guy like me is sitting there at
right.
the edge of my seat waiting for. But I've got gigs of these recordings that are now saved as WAV files. And so I can
hide them, Joshua,
well,
if you know what I mean.
Well, I've already sent copies to various trusted associates. So even if the men in black come and kill me, it does no good. you know, it's out there already to some of the people who understand the significance. So, I mean, this is, as soon as I was able to get transfers, boom, copies went out to trusted people. So I will indeed now send you copies of what I've got here. And
right.
Who knows? I mean, the engineer there at Coast to Coast AM might be the first person to actually extract some of these conversations. But the potential is showing us that, you know, we do have a conversation regarding something secret here.
This is amazing. How do you stumble into this stuff?
Well, you know, it's intriguing. For one thing, I have this incredible synchronicity in my life, I suppose. But more than that, I think it's because that I go looking for it. You know, this is my full-time job, and people know that I'm interested in strange things, and they come to me all the time, and they bring me these things, and they give me access to them. And I've been really fortunate because, you know, when you have enough friends and enough resources, you can get things done that you could not accomplish if you had $1 million.
That's true.
You know, some things can't be bought. They must be earned. And so, you know, I'm at a point now where, you know, I am delving into phenomenal mysteries that are giving me greater insight into ghosts, cryptids, psychic activity, UFOs, and some of these massive conspiracies. And, you know, in fact, the last time I was on your show, I was talking about the new footage of the Brown Mountain Lights. And then you had Dean Worsing on. You talked to him about shooting them. And I actually posted some of the original footage of the Brown Mountain Lights as well on my website so people can compare the two. And when we were up there working on our original Brown Mountain Lights research in the early 2000s and going up until especially around, I guess, 2005, I became involved with a lot of people who said that there was some conspiracy happening at a place like Brown Mountain because there are all these odd stories about vehicles that drive toward the mountain and then vanish as though they've gone to some underground base. And so I started wondering if there was some type of an energy there that the military might be interested in because we know something is producing these lights. Well, that culminated in us reproducing the lights on a miniature scale in a laboratory, in a plasma chamber. And what I found was that in the lab where I was working on this plasma chamber experiment, Charles Yost, the man who owned the lab, introduced me to another technology, which ties into something I'd like to tell you tonight. It's called Schlieren imaging or Schlieren optics.
How do you spell that?
It's spelled S-C-H-L-I-E-R-E-N. And Schlieren is an almost magical type of imaging. Basically, the Schlieren setup, and I can give you more details about how it works if you like, but the Schlieren setup allows you to put a camera in a room that is ultimately facing a large astronomical quality concave mirror.
All right.
And when everything is arranged properly, you have to have a special polarized pinhole light source, and then you have a razor blade that cuts through the light. When everything is put into proper place, suddenly there is this magical moment when any object that is placed in front of the camera shows very clearly a great deal of energy that is rising from it and disturbing the air around it. So, for example, if you put your hand in front of the Schlieren system, you will see these very large waves of energy and heat turbulence sort of flowing off of the hand. And it doesn't have to be heat, however. Anything that disturbs the air will show up because if there is a differential in the density of the air in front of the camera, you can see it. So all of a sudden, this invisible world becomes visible. And the gentleman who was using the Schlieren system, Charles Yost, he was, to my knowledge, the first person incorporating it to look at the aerodynamic properties of electrical discharges and electrodes because he was trying to figure out how a UFO flies.
Interesting.
And we know there are all kinds of, you know, electrical things surrounding UFOs and and the idea of the flying saucer, all these effects, you know. So what he did was he was producing these large discharges and seeing exactly how the air would flow, similar to how you might use a smoke tunnel or something like that in the old days. Well, he discovered something. He found that when he took an electrode and he placed it in front of the lens, and we're talking about an electrode from a generator like a Wimshurst generator or something similar, which produces a lot of electrostatic energy. There was this little stream that came shooting out of the electrode. Now, this stream was invisible to the naked eye. You could see it very well in the Schlieren system. Well, he presumed, well, I guess this must just be a flow of electrical ions. So he took the other electrode, the opposite electrode, and brought it over. And it would, of course, if it were electricity, just warp over to the opposite electrode because different charges attract. Well, he brought that opposite electrode over, and guess what? It didn't affect it. So then he brought a ground probe up to it. That didn't affect it. So he said, huh, this is weird. Apparently this is not electrical. So then he brought a magnet up to it and waved the magnet around it and threw it. Guess what? Did not affect it. So then he took a candle and he put the candle underneath it with all the heat rising up violently from the candle. Guess what? That did not affect it. So this man, who was a Hall of Fame, NASA Hall of Fame engineer, was sitting back scratching his head, and he couldn't figure out what this was. If it's not electric or magnetic, what is it? Well, Charles Yost, not too long after finding this, he got sidetracked on some other projects, and he told me that he wasn't sure what it was. He died never knowing what it was, but that it wasn't really relevant to what he was working on. Well, we at Lemur, we became so intrigued with this that I wanted to reproduce this in the laboratory and see if we could figure out what this is and if it might actually be a new form of energy. Well, I know we're coming up on a break here, but I will tell you, we just successfully reproduced this phenomenon, and it has implications, I believe, in actually allowing us to do what we've always wanted to do, and that is to open a portal to another dimension.
Well, in as much as you bring this up, too, and you have talked about mirrors, I want to get into the specifics with you, too, Joshua. If mirrors are indeed portals to the spirit world, because a lot of people have experimented, and I'm not so sure that's a great idea. Other people, by the way, like Winston Churchill, they used to give their speeches in front of a mirror. Woodrow Wilson did it. George Patton perfected his scowl by using the mirror technique, as they call it, to build up and influence their own power. But are mirrors portals to the world? What do you think, Joshua?
You know, that is an excellent question, and there is so much to talk about there. It reminds me especially of the psychomantium technique that Dr. Raymond Moody has talked about on your show. You know, Dr. Moody uses mirrors in order to give people very three-dimensional, tangible, interactive experiences with apparitions. I brought Dr. Moody here to Asheville, North Carolina, and had him train me and a variety of other people in his technique. I built a psychomantium at my house, and some of the stuff that has happened there, you just wouldn't believe. I've seen people come out of that room sobbing because of what happened inside. So we can get into all that and mirrors, and if there's anybody listening who doesn't understand exactly what I'm talking about, during the break, go to joshuapwarren.com. And click the link to the Brown Mountain footage, and you'll see a link to our lab there as well.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Floating Format, Joshua P. Warren, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, I can't wait to get my mitts on some of those wire recordings. Joshua's going to send me the MP3 versions of what he has. We'll get them up to engineer Dan, pile more work on Daniel, and see if he can slow the speed of those voices down. Worst comes to worst, we'll send them out to an audio company. But I think we've got the equipment to do that. When we come back, we'll continue chatting with Joshua P. Warren. We'll talk about the psychomantium and how they work as well. And then next hour, we'll take phone calls with Joshua on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, Joshua P. Warren. Joshua, back to your mirror story, then we'll get into the psychomantiums.
Absolutely. And let me just say that after the show tonight, I am going to post some footage that has never been released before of strange phenomena at Brown Mountain as well. So that's, again, an example of good timing because I've got it ready to go here. And I know what this program can do to websites, so if anybody has a problem, there is a mirror site, shadowboxent.com. My company is called Shadowbox Enterprises, and shadowboxent.com will get you to some of that as well. And you can also see in the lab what I'm talking about using the Schlieren optical setup that incorporates the concave mirror. We have been able to find that, indeed, Charles Yost was correct. There is some type of what appears to be a new form of energy that he called a coherent thread-like stream. We are now calling this the ray. We don't know what the ray is. We know at this point that it's not affected by electricity, magnetism, radioactive sources, heat turbulence. And, in fact, we are now starting to think that instead of this being a ray of energy that we are producing, we might actually be seeing an absence of energy that has been revealed because we are disturbing the area around it. So what I'm really saying here is we hear scientists talking about dark matter, dark energy, the dark flow, this sort of, if you will, an energy. Again, it's difficult to define, but an energy that is defined by the fact that it doesn't have the properties of anything we're able to measure. So if we have found a way of visualizing a dark flow, whatever this thing is we're calling the ray, then we are planning on, in the new lab, expanding this thing to get it bigger and bigger and bigger so that we can actually look through it, look down the center of a ray, and who knows what we're going to see on the other side. It could mean that we have actually these rays of some connecting force that are almost like a spider web that connects all matter in the universe, everything from the Earth to another body in space, to you and the cup of coffee sitting on the table in front of you. And this could actually be that key that we've been looking for to giving us some type of a window into other places. So you can see how utilizing this concave mirror technique, this could give us an example of how we are able to take mirrors in a variety of ways and use them to create visualizations that allow us to peer into other realms. So is all of this making a lot of sense? Because I've never really tried to explain it before, George.
You're doing okay. You're doing okay.
I'm talking about things here that don't really have a name. You know, we're having to define this as we go along. And it reminds me of the quote by Einstein, if we knew what we were doing, we wouldn't call it research. But this indeed could be the key to that. And if using this technique, we are able to finally see into other portals, and I'm being very speculative here about this possibility, but this is going to maybe give us a deeper understanding of just why and how mirrors have been used throughout the centuries in a variety of ways to induce paranormal experiences, such as in the psychomantium. And before we jump straight to the psychomantium, of course, people probably realize that, you know, mirrors and other reflective surfaces have been used for scrying, which is a form of psychic activity to see the past or the future for a long time. And what I found when I first started going into haunted houses many years ago was that I'd walk in the door somewhere and the person at the house would say, "This is the haunted room." And I would go into the haunted room, and the first thing I would notice was that there were two large mirrors that were facing each other somewhere in the room. And the owner had just put these in for artistic or aesthetic purposes, never realizing that what they were doing was actually creating an environment that seems to provoke these paranormal experiences.
Yep.
And in fact, one thing that we are going to try soon in the lab is something that I've heard about for years, a phenomenon known as the Devil's Toy Box. And essentially what you do is you take six square mirrors and you glue them all together to form a cube with the reflective surfaces on the inside of the cube. And when this is done, then there have been many people who have told me that they can hear growling and other weird, chilling noises within the box and that emanate strong enough for you to hear them outside the box. So if you wonder why is it that a mirror could have these special properties, well, if we think about a mirror as something that reflects energy, and it reflects especially, of course, the energy that we use in order to see what's around us visually, and you put two of them face to face, what's happening here is that you are creating this sort of bouncing of energy back and forth to a certain resonance. And when you look into a mirror, if it's facing another mirror, what you see is what appears to be an infinite tunnel.
Forever. Forever.
A mirror, yeah, exactly. It's like infinity, you know.
Yep.
And so if this is an infinite tunnel that we are able to see, and we know that we see light, then essentially we're looking into an infinite tunnel of light. And if these entities that we are working with, such as ghosts, are residing on a plane of electromagnetic energy, then they might actually take advantage of that in order to travel in and out of our realm. So this could explain to some degree why that I keep seeing mirrors facing mirrors in haunted places. Now, of course, when it comes to the psychomantium, instead of having a mirror facing a mirror, we have what is a rather basic setup in which there is a human being facing the mirror.
And let's explain this. The Greeks used psychomantiums. They relied on the oracles who used them. Nostradamus used them for his future events. He put himself in a dimly lit chamber with a large chalice or bowl filled with water. Now, they say this is key to anyone who wants to construct their own psychomantium. Why is that important? Josh, do you know?
Well, you know, let me first say that, you know, when Dr. Moody discovered this, all he was doing was trying to go back and kind of recreate and modernize what the ancient Greeks were doing, as you said, because the ancient Greeks had a much more elaborate system where they would take someone who wanted to contact the dead, place that person in isolation for weeks or even months, and have that person dwell upon the deceased individual to be contacted. And when the timing was right, that person would walk through a dark, desolate chamber until finally they would arrive at a spot where there was this large, highly polished cauldron full of water, and they would stare into it by the flickering candlelight, and over time they would not only see the image of the deceased person, but most extraordinarily, they would actually see that image materialize into a form that would extend from the water and manifest as a fully three-dimensional figure before the individual. And then they could have a normal conversation, no different than we would have standing face to face. So Dr. Moody discovered that you can really get the same effect if you simply take a significantly large mirror and you place it on a wall in a room that is quiet and isolated. You put a comfortable chair a few feet in front of it. You put a dim light source behind you. And also some type of white noise seems to help. And then as you stare ahead, you want to make sure the mirror is positioned so that you cannot actually see your own reflection. So it has to be a little bit higher. you're still looking into the mirror, but you're not being distracted by seeing yourself. And people who want to contact the dead, they go into this situation, and they have experiences that are exactly like the ones that the Greeks described. And so I constructed a psychomantium at our laboratory at the New Lemur Lab, and prior to that, I had one constructed at my house. And now that has become known as the haunted room at my house. And the funny thing is, if you have someone come over to your house and that person is grieving and the person wants to contact the dead and you sit down and you take them through this process of reliving their most vivid memories with the dead person and you ask them to bring an object with you and you really sort of give them this very strong suggestion that they are going to see it, when they go into the room by themselves in isolation and have the experience, you could say, well, this is some form of hypnosis that I've assisted here. But where it gets weirder is when the person has no idea what the psychomantium is and they still have an experience. For example, there was a young woman who came over to my house with a couple of my friends, and I'd met her for the first time. And so she didn't really know much about me, and one of my friends asked about the psychomantium. Well, the young woman says, what's a psychomantium? And I started to tell her, and then I just caught myself. And I said, well, instead of me telling you what it is, how about I use you as a guinea pig in a little experiment?
And was she willing for this?
Oh, yeah, she was excited. She was a very, you know, optimistic, open-minded person. She says, oh, okay, sure.
And trusted you.
Yes, she did. I wondered later if she regretted that. But I said, what I'd like you to do is go into that room and just sit down in this chair and make yourself comfortable and stare at this mirror, and we're going to leave you alone for maybe half an hour or so. I'm going to put on a little white noise, and you just relax. The only thing I'm going to ask you to do is just keep your eyes on that mirror. It's okay if you blink or whatever, but just keep your gaze on the mirror. Okay, no harm done. She wasn't afraid of the dark. So she went into the room, and I didn't hear anything from the room. 30 minutes later, true to my word, I went over, I opened the door, and she was sitting there just sobbing. She was an emotional wreck. And instantly there was this, you know, sort of awkward tension in the air. And I sat down with her and I said, are you okay? And she was speechless for a moment. And then she looked at me and said, what did you do? And I said, well, I really didn't do anything. What happened? And she told me that at some point, and you have to be mindful of the fact that people in the psychomantium, they lose track of time. It just becomes meaningless.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. There is no time.
Yeah, it's all a perceptive illusion, of course. And so, and that's another thing. Generally, you ask people to remove their wristwatch or anything like that when they go into the psychomantium so that they're not distracted by that. So she said at one point, her grandmother appeared in the mirror. And her grandmother had raised her. And when her grandmother died, they never had that final moment to say their goodbyes. And she said that the grandmother actually extended from the mirror, and the next thing she knew, her grandmother was standing in the room in front of her. She was, of course, shocked at this. Her grandmother walked over, embraced her just as warmly as she used to, whispered in her ear, you know I love you, and I've always loved you. And then her grandmother turned and faded back into the darkness. And this was such an enormous life-altering experience for her that that was the end of the night. She had to go home. And so she came out, and I was concerned. I thought, wow, you know, did she see this as a positive or negative thing, you know? And so she went home. And 2 days later, she contacted me, and she said, that was the most wonderful experience I've ever had. She said, at the time, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what to think of it. It didn't make any sense to me. And she asked me again what I had done. And I told her, you know, I really didn't do anything. That this is not about me. I'm not some wizard who created this experience for you. This is what happens when people go into this setting and they have some unfinished business in their minds that needs to be attended to. And in terms of how it works and why it works, we cannot know for certain. There was a time when I thought this is maybe a purely subjective experience, something that the individual manifests for his or herself almost like a dream. But then we've had times when we've captured things in the psychomantium that don't fall within that category. In fact, when Dr. Moody was doing the workshop here in Asheville, Mark Nesbitt, who, of course, is famous for his research on the ghosts of Gettysburg and many of the Civil War sites, he was in attendance. And Mark went into a psychomantium that we had set up for the event, and he, unbeknownst to the rest of us, brought a little audio recorder in with him, something you don't usually do because, again, you want to rule out those potential distractions. Well, when he emerged, he played his audio tape, and on this audio recording, I know I say tape, but it was actually digital, on this recording were some of the creepiest things I've ever heard. If you imagine what it might sound like if there were a chamber of demons grunting and howling, this is what it sounded like. I mean, stuff that immediately would make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And in fact, many of the people in the room actually visibly shuddered and grabbed themselves and didn't even want to hear any more of it, because it was one of those things that immediately strikes a nerve, because you know that it's so clear and so real. And so the fact that he got that, and he still has that recording, in fact, I need to email him and tell him while we're sending the audio to you, we may as well throw that audio in as well.
Absolutely. Hey, are you? Do you still check in on that story of Robert the Haunted Doll?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've never actually seen Robert face to face, but
he's down in Key West, Florida, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's right. He's on display in a museum, and there are members of my team who have gone down there and seen him. And just like so many other people, they'll take a photograph of him, and sometimes the image is entirely wiped out. It's just overexposed. And I've always been intrigued with that because I did a TV program in 2005 that aired on TLC, the Learning Channel, called Possessed Possessions. And it was kind of like an antiques roadshow for haunted and cursed items. And so people came from all over the country bringing everything from these creepy little dolls to, say, surgical tools from the Civil War that had seen horrific things. One guy showed up and brought a hearse. And they had some psychics who would stay sequestered until they came out, and they told the story about what they felt was coming from the objects. And I was there to be the person to take measurements and see if there was anything we could quantify about what was surrounding them. And over this period of a week, seeing hundreds of these items, I was really surprised at how many objects actually do emanate some kind of pulsation. Sometimes there would be a high charge, usually a positive ion charge around them. In other cases, we would have a series of very strong, sharp electrostatic pulsations around them. And the creepiest thing that I saw was a cursed mask from Africa that was in the possession of a man who himself, after getting it, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And he was told when he received this that people around it came, you know, who came into contact with it and especially who touched it would die. Well, I had a pretty harrowing experience with that we might get to.
All right. And just search Robert the Doll. You'll see him. He's really kind of spooky. A possessed doll. Back in a moment with more stories from Joshua P. Warren and some of your phone calls next.